This is the Bungie Line. My name's Ted Hager.
And I'm Alex Barnett. And I'm just still wondering what that noise was.
That's called a didgeridoo. It's kind of got a little bouncy sound
to it.
That's
from Aussie, from Aussieland.
Yeah. Put another shrimp on the Barbie. That's what that is.
It's good. I like it.
Yeah. That'll be our sound at the beginning of the show. And it's our first show.
Okay, cool. Coming up in just a moment, we interview John Musser from Programmable Web. It's a top website covering web APIs and the websites that are implementing those APIs and mashups in new innovative ways.
But before we get into that, let's tell people a little bit about what this podcast is, besides our highly professional introduction where we discuss even our sound at the beginning of the show. And the Bungie Line, our goal here is to cover a lot of different topics about programming to the web and using web APIs and those kind of things, making rich websites. And we have two feeds, actually. We have a feed for our feature interviews, which this John Musser interview today is one of. And then we also have another feed that is much more specific to the platform that Bungie Labs provides, which is called Bungie Connect. So you can actually subscribe to the feed for feature interviews only, or you can subscribe to the channel that covers both Bungie Connect and the feature interviews, or you can just get the Bungie Connect side if that's what interests you. So whichever you want. Now, Alex, you've been working in this space for a little while, right? You've come from Microsoft. What were you doing there?
I was community program manager with a team called Data Programmability, which is the engineering team responsible for the data access stack across the Microsoft platform. So it'd be things like Edia.net, MDAX, Snack, JDBC.
Okay, so you've been working in the actual web API space, whereas I've been more in the Linux space a little bit. You've been doing some more things around that area. You've covered it quite a bit in
right,
your blog.
Right, well, yeah, the data programmability is coming more from the traditional computing side of things. It's kind of more of the traditional Windows development platform. Connectivity to databases, normally where you've got direct line of sight as part of the network. But I've been interested outside of that, really with respect to how the programming model for the kind of next generation of websites that we're seeing are using more and more essentially APIs across the network. And they can be data, they can be services. And I think that that is an interesting area because it shows the trends of where we're going with regards to programming interactive, rich websites in the future where all your data is not on the same cluster of servers. They're literally distributed across the web and you're stitching these things together as a programmer to make a single interface into it.
Cloud-based applications, essentially. And that's kind of where you got to know John a little bit because you've met our guest, John Musser, before, correct?
Yeah, he lives in Seattle, where I lived for about 3 years. I'd been subscribing to his blog for a little while when he came on the scene with Programmable Web. And then I bumped into him in the Seattle Mind Camp, the first one. That was two and a half years ago, where we bumped into each other and just got chatting and really kept in touch with him ever since. And following his site, all the APIs and mashups that he tracks, which is a great service, I think, to anybody who's needing to program using APIs, they can use it as a reference site.
Right. So with that, that gives a little bit of what John's doing and everything. Shall we get into the interview?
Sure.
John, welcome to the Bungie Line. We're glad you could join us. How's it going?
Going great. Good to be here.
Good. So we wanted to talk to you today a little bit about various things about web technologies and things, but we wanted to start with your website, Programmable Web. And maybe you could give us a little bit of an idea about the site, what it's all about, why you've got it there, how it started, that kind of stuff.
Sure. Programmable Web actually turns 2 years old next week, I think, sometime in August. It's a resource for developers that includes a directory of about 500 open web APIs, Web 2.0 APIs, a few thousand mashups that people have built with it, so it's sort of a reference and research repository, and then it's a developer community, so there's resources like tutorials, and there's community profiles, promote their mashups. So it's sort of this hub of the mashup universe. And so 2 years ago, the short story is that I was researching some business ideas and it relied on these new web APIs like the Amazon API and couldn't find a single, sort of found bits and pieces all over the web, but there wasn't really the thing that I expected to see, which was a site where you would go and find out about this stuff. So I just collected these resources, put them up, and the next 2 weeks later, it was picked up by O'Reilly Radar, and traffic shot up. And ever since then, it turns out that that's the business, because there was a need.
You mean programmable web is the actual...
So programmable web is the business, as opposed to the thing that I was originally researching 2 years ago.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I remember, John, when you first kind of went live with it, or very, very soon after that. It must have been maybe an O'Reilly Radar blog post that I saw.
Yeah.
And I've been following you, I think, for at least 2 years. It's been amazing to see how you've been growing that site and documenting these APIs. And I think it's fair to say that there is no other resource on the web that is as comprehensive as yours, and just keeps up people updated. So I find it personally a very useful resource to see what's going on in the API space.
So
thank you. Very good.
If you would, John, maybe what can developers get out of the site then? I mean, they get all these API listings, but what are some of the components of the sites? I know you have like an ongoing blog where you talk about different things in there.
Right, so there's the blog, which has posts nearly every day. We just rolled out, for example, there's a series, one of the most popular things of all time, and this was a couple months after we launched, was something called the Mashup Matrix. And the Mashup Matrix is this two-dimensional interactive grid where on the X and Y axes are the APIs, and the cells in the middle of the grid show you what people have built with that combination of APIs. So you can move around and hover the mouse and sort of see which APIs have been very popular and which where things haven't been connected. And every day as there's new mashups, the matrix grows and gives you a sense of what people have built or not built. I've had some people from API providers tell me that they use it as a strategic way to see what people are combining with what or what they're not, thinking about where an opportunity is or maybe a dead market. Another feature on the site is something called the API scorecard, which takes the sort of gamey top six API providers. So there's Google, Amazon, Microsoft, eBay, Yahoo, AOL as essentially the main API providers these days.
All those big boys.
Certainly with the most sort of variety of APIs, I mean, sort of excluding folks like Salesforce.com, obviously very influential, but they Salesforce is much more focused with really just their one API.
Yeah, and there's a lot of them, John. So how are you finding about all these new APIs and these new mashups as they're coming around?
Well, originally, of course, we dug them up ourselves. Mm. Nowadays, we get a good percentage of them coming directly to us, API providers. We have a share form, and folks come in and say, hey, we have a new API.
Right.
So you've passed that critical mass point. Now people are coming to you and giving you the stuff. That's nice.
Yep. And the people who, whether they do it or whether we get it through some other means, API owners can claim their API, and that allows them to maintain their profile on programmable web. So in the last 3 days, we've had six or seven API providers say, hey, I want to claim my API, and that gives them the ability to keep it fresh or accurate.
So how about the trends there going on right now in APIs? Like we started out with a lot of these type of like SOAP services and things like that, where it was a lot of data stuff that you could get back, and now there seems like there's a lot more stuff coming out that's actually doing transformative things with things you submit. Geocoding APIs would be a real simple example of that. What kind of things do you see starting to come about more in APIs?
Can you say Facebook? I think that really, it's just, I can't have a conversation with anyone these days that doesn't somehow revolve around Facebook, and we're talking about platforms and APIs. You know, it was really kind of the, you know, so there's been a technical transport, which we can talk about in a second, but really from a industry perspective, really in the 2 years that I've been following the space, nothing's changed the space more than the platform launched 3 months ago, the Facebook platform. And it was really kind of, for people, in particular for their competitors, but I think for the industry as a whole, it's a bit of a sea change. And
do you want to give us, John, an overview of the various APIs that they have, just in terms of categories of types of data and functionality that they have?
Oh, the Facebook guys?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so they really, originally, that last fall, they came out with their Facebook API, which allows you to query some identity and friend information, and I don't know, maybe a quarter of the functionality of Facebook, maybe less, but sort of at least get to the core, finding out about the profiles and the connections among people. And then this, I think it was May of this year, certainly in the spring, when they launched the Facebook platform. And that original API was very traditional. You would query it, pull the data out, it would have to be authenticated with the user, and then you'd be writing it in a mashup or an API that lived on your own server or somewhere else. And then one of the fundamental changes that occurred with the platform, the Facebook platform this spring, was that effectively it's this inside-out or almost inverted API, where you're developing on your own server, but yet your application lives underneath the Facebook umbrella. So it's totally integrated within and nearly seamlessly integrated with the Facebook environment. So as a Facebook user, when I load a third-party application, I can just click and say install, and I never really leave Facebook, which is very different than the traditional mashup or application built with third-party APIs.
I've seen a bit of quite a bit of interest from the data nuts out there talking about essentially Facebook SQL and the data.
Yeah, that was a good one. Right.
Right. So
it was very interesting.
Yeah, go on. What do you? Why do you think that's interesting?
Right. And that was part of a follow-on to the original API. So what they decided to do with FQL, as they call it, or Facebook SQL, was think about data retrieval in a way. They observed some issues with traditional web APIs, like, and they contrasted this in their talk at WebDeployment Expo with the Flickr API, which is a very good, very popular API. But one of the classic issues you have with that web services, either XML RPC or the REST API, is that you can't control, for example, what columns get back. So you make an API call to say get photo info, and you're going to get back all the data that they've defined comes back with that call. So there's a bit of extra overhead. Could be a lot of overhead with that in terms of data transfer. Also, the number of calls, you can't batch them. So anyway, they came up with an interesting model they called Facebook SQL, which mimicked more closely the semantics of a SQL call. And you could say, I want to do this constraint as if it were a where clause, and then you could say, I want to get these columns back. And you had much sort of finer control of what you were asking for and what you were getting back than you did with most other competing web service APIs.
That's got to give a lot for like optimization of just like your applications as well, because you're no longer having to sort through the data at your own end. You're just saying, just give me the part that I'm interested in.
Absolutely.
John, we've spoken in the past around how there's this missing piece in the distributed web. I mean, we've got all this functionality available to us through these APIs. We've got specific data sources available to us through these APIs, but a programmable data store, you know, applications these days, especially on the web, without any data, aren't going to be doing anything very interesting. And it's great if somebody's got some of the data that you need and you're able to do some recombination of two types of data or whatever, but in terms of having your own data store out in the cloud that's programmable, where do you see Facebook SQL in that respect, and what other programmable services are you looking at in that space?
Well, and as you know, I mean, there's a variety of things coming down the pipeline, like Microsoft's Astoria, which is one of the most interesting ones, as a trying to look for a REST interface into a structured data set, and trying to not necessarily mimic SQL, but to find that the magic combination of being able to have structured data, which, for example, we don't have today with the classic quote-unquote data store on sort of Web 2.0 data store, Amazon's S3, which is more of a blob-based storing objects type of data store, as opposed to something more field-based and structured. So the story is very interesting. And I think, you know, for a little while it's been Google Base, and I think we'll just see more and more people looking at that type of, how do we make a RESTful structured data store work?
Have you seen anybody starting yet? Like, have you covered anything about people using Astoria in its early phases here?
Not yet, I think. Certainly not that I've seen. I mean, there's obviously been good word of mouth, and folks are definitely working on it, and I suspect later this year we'll see more. You can also contrast that a bit to, again, Google Base, where they've taken more of an Atom, you know, from a technical perspective, they've taken more of using the Atom protocol and Atom publishing protocol, sort of extending that to build that data model.
Yeah, it's curious to me that we're not further down the path on this on the internet today. I mean, do you know what I mean? I mean, that even now, at the end of the summer of 2007, there isn't really a relational programmable data store that's out there that you can essentially rent, create your own schema and program against. Does that seem weird to you, John, or do you think, no, it's still early days?
It certainly seems like it's a fundamental piece of the infrastructure equation that we don't have. And also, if you think about the fact that there are these startups out there that do online quickie databases and so on, yet there isn't a good or a real API for some of those as well.
DoubleDB's got an API of sorts, hasn't it?
Sorts, but not in the same league as what you're looking at with Astoria.
Right. So, and I guess apart from the obvious distinction between REST and SOAP-based web services, I mean, okay, so we've seen a general trend to more and more REST, right? People want things simple, they want it quick, they want it fast, they don't want to have to learn WS, Death Star, etc. What other trends, though, are you seeing, John, with respect to the design of the APIs that are coming out?
You hit the nail on the head as far as I see, which is just simplify.
So REST is serving to Eclipse in that sense? It's starting to take over?
Yeah, absolutely. So you see a lot more REST than you do SOAP. If you're sort of just total, exposed types of APIs from an architectural perspective. But then even within that, you start to move towards JSON, JavaScript object notation, as being preferred, or certainly a favored data format as opposed to just XML, because it can be smaller, less overhead, faster to consume, or even JSON RPC as a protocol for some of the larger API providers of late. Again, so you almost take that as one more level of simple. So you have more complex, most complex of the data, as Alex said, the WS Death Star combinations from the quote-unquote old days, and then REST, and then you have within REST the idea of using JSON or a lighter weight, either RPC or data format.
Right. Do you see some major shift happening along with those APIs in just like sort of forcing people that are making the various development platforms out there to have to jump on these things? Do you see them going very fast or anything? Like JSON is bringing in, different format for people to have to wrangle around with now. Is that causing all these platforms to have to jump, and are some of them moving faster than others, or how's that space
that's
working?
That's a good question. I couldn't tell you whether it was moving faster than others, but it certainly becomes effectively a requirement for the platform.
It's kind of funny that it's ironic in a way that the simpler and simpler we get, the faster these platforms have to move to grab on to these new formats and things.
You would have thought it might have gone the other way, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Starting simple and gotten complex.
Usually move toward complexity is the thing there.
All right. Well, maybe we've already gone through that whole cycle, simple a decade or more ago and then got more complex. Standards of the big companies came in, and now it's been the revolt.
So simple's good, right? Simple accelerates the ability for people to start playing and getting the data that they want and all the rest of it. And that's great for data transfer, okay? If we're talking about a richer type of API, really where you're now talking about connecting to a truly distributed service out there that you're wanting to connect to and program against, there's this conversation, SOAP is dead and REST this, that, and the other. I mean, my personal view is that the one won't be replacing the other completely, 100%. There'll be a mix of both offerings. But do you see there being a necessary constraint around REST with respect to the APIs that are available for more of the richer type services. I'm not talking about just data transfer, but about actually invoking functions across the wire.
Yeah, that's a very fabulous subject of debate these days, as to whether sort of whether REST can quote unquote do everything that some of the more complex protocols and traditional certainly SOAP ones have been up to the task for. But I think that it, you know, there's a good argument to be made that it doesn't necessarily fall down. It depends how you build upon it. And I think, again, folks who use or GData, right? So, and again, we haven't quite seen exactly what Microsoft's strategic coherent protocol will look like, but certainly Google is quite interestingly adding more and more of their what they call GData APIs, which are their Atom publishing protocol, which is a very RESTful protocol, right? I think that they would make an argument that that's good enough, that you can solve some pretty hardcore writable, rewrite, distributed technology problems using that model. Really, we haven't talked about the biggest problem, which is identity. Right? Security and identity are the biggest problem.
Yeah, that's it's funny that you bring that up, because that's one of the things that we're constantly, with our own platform, Bungie Connect, we're constantly talking about that one with some of our early adopters. It's one of the main things out there. So what do you think of some of the identity things out there, like OpenID initiative and those kind of things?
That makes me curious. So what sort of issues do you have folks sort of coming to you with saying we need?
Well, a lot of times people are coming to us saying, okay, so what do we do about our user data? We want to create users and things like that. And it seems like it's a little bit retro in that people are saying, I want to make my own user database and those kind of things. Meanwhile, you've got things like Yahoo's BBAuth and those kind of things that are making more internet identities. Same thing with OpenID. But it seems that right now, most of the developers I'm dealing with are asking questions a lot about how they can create their own accounts and just manage their own accounts rather than hitting some of the web-capable authentication and identity systems.
Yeah, so therein lies part of the problem. There's so many knotty issues with identity and the security piece. OpenID is interesting, of course, because there's a gazillion OpenID providers and very few people who will accept it. That's a bit of an interesting a reflection on the state of OpenID at the moment.
So what about the security side of things, John? What are you noticing there?
You know, and again, we're talking about, you know, sort of as you get closer to whether you're going to be poking at my bank account, people get a lot more interested in security than they do when you're just talking about, you know, putting markers on a map. And so it becomes there's a lot more at stake, and it does become much harder for everyone to sort of feel like, both as an individual, a group, an organization, a company, strategic level, to make for all of us to sort of get on the same page from just a trust or even a liability perspective. So we see each major API provider, all those gamey ones that are in our scorecard, they all have their own identity. You know, there's the Yahoo's BBAuth, and there's Google's WebAuth or ClientAuth, and LiveID for Microsoft, and OpenAuth for AOL. So everyone's got their own, because you kind of have to start there to at least have something. And we're all not almost like I get in a room and agree overnight what the common standard should be.
Yeah, and you've got some arguing that.
We're going to wait and see how it shakes out.
Yeah, and that you've got some arguing that closed is the new open, right? With these social networks, and you know whether a debate the last week or two, I've seen blog posts around whether you know something like OpenID really is in the interest of the social network. No, it's not. They might argue. But if you had true interoperability across those social networks, would the net effect that you would actually be able to recruit more people because the barrier to signing up and creating an account is much lower rather than having to create a brand new account, which I think probably puts off a lot of people from a service as a consideration that they have. You know, where do you see the trends with respect to API openness, including identity, across these social networks? Is closed the new open?
I think closed is the new open, but I think what happens, I think even this week we saw that, there was a discussion about with Facebook and whether the feed was going to be an RSS feed. Mm. Again, there was just sort of this gradual opening up over time that's going to, no one knows exactly where that, how fast that'll happen, but we certainly see it, that inch by inch or brick by brick or hole in the dam, we're starting to see a trickle of more and more data coming out, right? I mean, there's no question that when Facebook opened up the platform, have been so tremendously successful in the last few months that it's the, that's the oh shit moment for the other social networks, right? They all turn around and go, oh, we're screwed because they built a successful platform and we don't have our API strategy in place. So then you have LinkedIn and MySpace and everyone else now playing catch up with this huge amount of momentum for Facebook. And really, you know, so even if it's not entirely as open as some folks might like, it put a ton of competitive pressure on the other guys, right?
Right, absolutely. And now we've got people actually trying to generate revenue from the apps that they're building against those APIs. Now, that brings into question around quality of service, right, and SLAs, and the messy business of, you know, if I've got an application that's making me money, it's my business, that's relying on your API, what are you seeing with respect to the SLAs and the quality of service and the kind of guarantees and lack of guarantees that are being made by API providers?
What SLAs?
Yes.
Is that really their response? So, but again, I think, you know, Amazon sort of set the stage for that to some extent, saying, listen, this is, we certainly at our scale, this is how we run our business. And so on the one hand, we don't guarantee it. And they have a few glitches, but really relatively minor compared to what one had before and to other choices. So I think there is a question about whether, you know, and certainly from a corporate perspective, and you're running your business on it, and at what point do you need to, I mean, you need to account for that. I mean, again, even if you're doing it behind the firewall with your own services, how do you have a strategy in place for handling outages and fault tolerance and caching and the sort of classic, you know, comp sci strategy, online strategies for dealing with?
But do you see it as a
of service?
Do you see it as a differentiator? So, for example, if we've got two guys who have got you know, one API provides precisely almost exactly the same data as another API provider.
Say a Live Maps versus a Google Maps kind of thing,
right,
or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but assuming that the data was exactly the same and the functionality was exactly the same, because there are differences there and feature sets. But assuming those two things, do you see SLA and quality of service as being a way for these API providers to be able to compete and win business over each other? Or do you think, not today, maybe in the future?
I think you had a good example there, thinking about the more commoditized functionality with the same mapping. We've seen that there are APIs available, even multiple, that there are SLA, you can buy license-supported, guaranteed SLA mapping services that are differentiated based upon that criteria. Folks are willing to pay for those, so whether it's the Google Maps Enterprise version or, again, the commercial side of MapQuest or Live Maps, and these folks who you pay five or seven figures to have a fully licensed, supported product and with an SLA. And so I think that if you can interchange those, then that definitely makes a difference.
So we have one other area of question that we wanted to ask you about before we wrap up here. And that is, we talked a little bit about money here and money there and some of the mashups and things like that. Certainly commerce is one of the areas that's very interesting for people that are creating web applications. And the world just got a little bit more interesting over the past several months in that we now see that PayPal is no longer alone as sort of the one way of paying for things or the primary way of paying for things out there. We've seen Google come out now with something. Amazon is coming up with flexible payment service. What are your thoughts on how all these things mix together? And do you see some advantages or disadvantages to some of the way these guys provide different APIs?
You talking about just the payment space in particular?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And again, talking about the competitive pressure when Amazon enters the space, as they did with the FPS, the flexible payment service, because that really shakes up the incumbent, which has historically been PayPal, because they have the largest and longest standing user base. Technically, Amazon has a has both A, well, one of the key things they did is that the API, the usage of the API reflects a scale payment structure so that they can pass along a greater cost savings depending on whether you're doing it with credit or direct payment, you know, all the different sort of flavors of banking fees, which when PayPal was basically the sole leader, they had a, you know, they have a greater margin. So anyway, there's a business of a competitive pressure there on pricing, and then technologically, it looks like, at least in my limited understanding of the flexible payment service API, there's a greater variety of API options that you can sort of save payment types. And
yeah, so pretty rich.
With a richer API, that could be a competitive advantage there.
I think it's a good time in this space. It's a good time for consumers because they can buy more stuff. It's a good start, good time for merchants because they can make it easier to sell stuff to consumers. It's a good time for the API providers because we've got developers that are using those APIs. And there's a kind of really interesting ecosystem that, you know, maybe 5 years ago.
Well, from what John's saying, is the other thing that's it's a good time for is the fact that, you know, PayPal suddenly has Amazon come out with a richer set of API or more flexible set of API. That makes it better for developers because now you're going to see a little bit of an arms race happen there on the API level too.
Yeah, and price race, presumably.
Yeah. Well, John, thank you very much for your time with us here. We really appreciate you taking a little bit of time out and giving us some of the insights and also a little bit of the overview of what Programmable Web's all about. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Ted, Alex.
Thanks very much, John.
So there you go, your first interview on the Bungie line. You've gotten to hear Alex and I talk to John Musser. Amazing stuff. But John's a pretty interesting guy. I mean, this is his stumble across it kind of thing. He started working on programmable web, and it ended up being his big idea. Whereas he was looking for his big ideas, he started doing this, and it just turned out to be that. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, and he's been extending the site with more and more useful services. It's a point of authority to understand how many APIs, who's releasing what mashups are based on which APIs. It's got a lot of graphing and data available. It's got a good community building up, and I think it'll be around to stay for some time.
Yeah, you can get a lot of different ideas by just going through the site and seeing some of the weird mashups that people have made out of different APIs that have come out. So if people want to check out the things that we talked about in this interview, we have several different links on our website. You can go to bungielabs.wordpress.com, and that's where we are hosting the site at the moment, and you can read through it. That's also the Bungie Connect Developer Network blog, so we're actually using it for multiple purposes. But all the links that you're looking for from this show will be on that blog, and you can also leave us comments and things like that. And we'd love to hear what direction you'd like us to take some of our interviews, what kind of guests you'd like us to have on the show, and so on. So with that, thanks very much for joining us.